Those are magnificent old fine great classics in the American tradition. Bring it up, Tony, please. La ta da da da, cha da chi chi da chi 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 da chi. We have here a letter. It says, Shepherd, who the hell listens to you? Well, now that's a direct question, and I'll have to answer that as best I can. Among those who listen to me is obviously my letter writer. And but no, it's a direct question, and I have to answer that by quoting Fred Allen, the famous line. Fred Allen was once asked where the people who came to his studio audience came from. And he said, there's a slow leak in Iowa. And there's no way to top that. I mean, because it says it for everybody and everybody, and you can't argue about where your audience comes from. After all, you know, where does Barbara Streisand's audience come from? Where does Mickey Mouse's audience come from? You know, I mean, it's all of us. You know, the whole thing together, and you can't separate yourself. You know, from fact, from fiction. And, you know, speaking of audiences, did I ever tell you about the time I was doing a show in the limelight? And you remember I used to do the Saturday Night Show in the limelight. For those of you who wonder why we don't do it any longer, it's obvious we were there 3 years, wasn't it? Something like that? 3 years. And at that point, you know, I just felt that I wanted to spring. You know, you see the same waiters and you get hit by the same pizzas night after night. And, you know, and after that, it's time to move on. And nevertheless, one night we're doing this show, see, and, you know, I'm amazed at how people's mind is affected by radio in the time sense. You know, I ran into a guy here not too long ago at NYU, a professor over there. Well, I was teaching a course there last year or so, and he's doing a paper on the idea, and a lot of research is going into it, on what happens to people's mind when they listen to the radio vis-a-vis time. People tend to think that time is much faster. I got a letter from a lady the other day. I couldn't believe it. And she said, "Hey, Mr. Shepherd, we're so delighted that you're doing these wonderful college programs, and I'm taking my sons to see you at Newark State College is. I'm a little hazy on that because my brain is getting a little soft. But I'll say this. We certainly are looking forward to you because I took my son to see you when you were down at that place in the village. I think it must have been, yes, it was, 15 years ago. Great Scott, that was, let's see, last year. It was a year and a half ago, you know. And now that's the truth. I mean, you know, I'll bet there's a lot of people out there who seriously believe they listened to me when they were kids. And they're now applying for Medicare. I'm serious. They're very, very serious. Because the radio does strange things to people. And nobody quite knows why that is. It in a sense, telescopes time. And one of the things that I've noticed about radio is that if you tell a story, like say quite often I'll tell a story about when I was a kid, primarily because I like to use the world of childhood as a literary device, you know, the way Mark Twain, say, would use it, or say, J.D. Salinger, somebody like that, because it's the one thing that we all shared. I don't care what race, what religion, what nationality you are, you know, we all share childhood. And we all share the thing of not knowing what the world is about and looking at the sun and growing up and vaguely getting an idea what it's about. And then all of a sudden you realize you didn't know it all. This is the whole problem and process of maturation. So that's a good literary device. But what I was going to say was that many people, if you tell a story about your childhood, and they listen, you see, and they get themselves involved in your story, that they begin to co-mingle what you've told with their childhood. In other words, a guy will hear me tell about a thing that happened to me and Schwartz and Flick and Bruner, and he'll say, "Oh, man, that's just the way it was. Oh, wow." You know, and he's hitting his friends. "Hey, Charlie, you hear that? I knew a guy just like Schwartz." And, all right, he's still safe. Well, then the next time I tell a story about Flick and Schwartz and Bruner, he listens, but he's a little quieter, see? And this time he says, oh, yeah, that's the way, oh, man, that's just the way it was. Well, about 2 weeks later, he begins to believe that he was a child when he was listening to me. Yeah, and so old guys have come creaking up to the stand, you know, with a cane in one hand. "Son, well, I can't believe it. I listened to you when I was a boy. I knew." And, you know, and what he was listening to when he was a boy was Marconi, who was playing around with the first spark gaps. But nevertheless, this is a strange situation, this business. And yet, you know, on the other hand, television seems to operate the opposite. People have very little memory about television, but great memories about radio. I'll let you think about that for a minute. It's quite true. In fact, most people cannot remember the top television show that was the biggest show, let's say, a year ago. They don't even remember watching it. How many of you remember, say, Route 66? That was, at one point, absolutely the number one show in the country. Everybody watched Buzz. What was his name? Buzz and something in Route 66. And they had this, Marty Milner was in it. Was it Vince Edwards was the other guy? No. Marty Milner? George Maharis, that's right. And this was the biggest thing since bottled beer, you know, everybody. And it's like the minute the show goes off, it's instantly forgotten on television. So there is no built-in, in a sense, memory distortion that's involved in television. Hardly anybody, for example, how many of you remember when the biggest thing, absolutely, it's just a sensational show, everybody was watching it, was Batman. You remember when everybody used to write about Batman, had big essays about Batman and all stuff? Well, me telling you this, you see, you're listening to this story here, and you say to yourself, yeah, I remember Batman. Oh, yeah, gee. And it's very hard for people to remember what year that actually was. And that was just, you know, comparatively recently in history. And so television has a tendency to have a built-in memory eraser. Whereas radio works the opposite. People will remember a radio show that they, practically word for word, guys will remember the opening theme, we'll say, or the opening line of every word that was in the opening of The Lone Ranger. They might have heard it, you know, 150 years ago. And so they know that out of the West, the stranger alone, you know, they remember every word. And yet if you ask them what they had for lunch yesterday afternoon, they can't remember. They can't even remember who they had lunch with. You know, a lot of guys walking around today, if you stop them real quick and say, "What's your name?" He'd say, "Oh, Fred, of course, Fred Gutstop." Well, it was a quick momentary grappling there, you see. I just wonder how many guys, if you wake them up real quick at 2 o'clock in the morning, real quick, you wake them up and say, quick, give me your telephone number. His telephone, he's probably had the telephone number for 20 years. But, on the other hand, if you say to him, who played the shadow? Oh, well, I'll tell you who played. Now, what is this, you know? It's a curious thing. And I can only say that you have not listened to me as long as you think you have. Now, I'm going to be swamped with letters, and every one of you are going to say, why I was with this girl. I'll never forget that night. I did not come to New York until the late 50s. Now, put that in your corn cob and smoke it, friend, whether you like it or not. Now, I'm going to get large numbers of letters from people saying, hi, that's not true. I remember when I was just a lad, I was going to Rutgers Polyclinical Dental School. Of course, I later failed out, but I was going to school with a girl, I believe her name was Agatha, and we were in a, it was a Willie's Night Sport Roadster, and and it's just, it's insane. You know, at this point, I don't even argue with people. Writers continually, whenever they write about your story, they always pretend like they were listening to you when they were kids. And I'll meet the writer, and he's 10 years older than I am, you know? You just come and take it. And that's what Fred Allen was really referring to when somebody said, where does your audience? He can't tell where his audience comes from, you know? They're like cockroaches. They're out there. And of course, Alan dug his audiences. He said that with humor, you see. And he was not putting it down. At the same time, he had a sardonic eye. And oftentimes I feel the same way about it. People ask me, what about your audience? And I rarely talk about my audience on the air at all, you see. But it's there. But what I'm always surprised at is the weird, the strange comments they'll make about, and how they'll misinterpret something completely that you said. Like a couple of nights ago, because one of the things you learn on radio, and I suspect it's even more so on television, is that the average person's attention span is roughly 3 to 4 milliseconds. He's good. His attention span is roughly that of a chipmunk. And he tends to act, though, however, on the misinformation that he is misabsorbed. For example, a couple of weeks ago, after Mr. Nixon made the Cambodia speech, I gave a little thing, I talked a little bit about it that night because a lot of people had called in, and I simply said I didn't think personally I was not for this thing. And instantly, I'm deluged with thousands of letters accusing me of being everything from a Black Panther to a paid agent of the Kremlin. Well, now, that's all right, you see, because hate is endemic to every population. I don't care where you go. If you think that's an American product, friend, that's because you don't know human nature. Do you agree with that, Tony? I mean, believe me. You'll find in every society, you'll find hate just pours out of people because it's part of the human nature, just as much as self-defense and as a desire to eat and everything else. We are a carnivore, after all. Nevertheless, in explaining what I said, I said, I don't hold with these people who walk around and say that the president is an idiot. You'll hear people say things like that. And I said, this is ridiculous. People who name call and who pretend that everybody's stupid, but they are, always bothers me. Instantly, I got 500 letters saying, I'll remember that. Don't forget. I'll remember that you called our wonderful president an idiot. Gee, listen, will you, before you pop off, friend? Listen, you're liable to get yourself in trouble someday. And you know what I find that is beginning to increase vastly? It's increased in the last, I'd say, 4 years to almost epidemic proportions. It's the unsigned warning letter. The unsigned warning letter from somebody who considers himself very hip. He knows everything, say. Never signs his letters and is generally, utterly suffused with hate. And I find that the more a person is embattled and feels his hates are not hates at all. They're just absolute, solid, considered positions on inferior people. this type generally tends to not want to sign their letters. It goes hand in hand with paranoia. In fact, one of the classic problems with the paranoiac is his desire continually to hide. He feels that the world is after him. He feels that that he's beleaguered. And generally, by the way, he feels that he is one of the few people who are right thinkers. This is another classic problem with paranoia. And so, ultimately, he tends to hide behind symbols and little things, little pen names and various things like that. Now, by the way, I'm immediately going to get the letters from a lot of people say, what do you mean the pen name was used by Charles Lamb and so on? But the reason that an author will use a pen name quite often has to do with things like contracts, simple basic things like he's got a contract with publisher Y, and so to write for publisher D, he has to use a name like Charlie Gutstop. Generally, every author I've ever known wants his name known very much. And, in fact, one of the biggest fights in many a publishing house is how big the author's name is going to be published on the dust jacket. Oh, that's a big fight, friend, I'll tell you. In fact, many an author has threatened simply to call his book his own name. I want my book called Charlie Gutstop Speaks. Well, wait a minute now. come on, please, who cares about the other? No, I want it, that's all. It took me over 2 weeks to write it. I sweat blood writing that book. I had to give up bowling and everything, 3 nights one time to write it. And I want it. Charlie Gutstop Speaks. Puts the dildocks in their place. Well, it's one of the, great, of course, that goes galloping hand in hand. Incidentally, speaking of the great, somebody has coined a beautiful expression to cover this. My friend Roger Price, one of my oldest friends, and Roger, you know him as a cartoonist, the guy that does the droodles and all that, but actually he's a very funny, sardonic guy in his own private life. And one of his great phrases is the great boob revolution. He likes to call people rubes. The great rube, excuse me, not boob, the great rube revolution. And he's continually concerned with the rubes. Now, for example, he has a book out recently, and I'm not plugging this book. I'm simply saying here's a typical example of what we're talking about. Rube Conversation, where the classic rube was traditionally taciturn or laconic, the new basic rube is a talker. A basic conversation consists of two or more of them taking turns reciting what has happened to them recently. In order of importance, the subjects of these continual rube recitals are 1. TV. 2. How much they had to drink last Saturday night. Or the last time they were in Chicago. 3. Quote, interesting facts, or as usually pronounced, interesting facts about automobiles, prices of, routes, and mileage. 4. Interesting facts about job. 5. Sports, male only. 5A. Kids, home furnishings, hairsprays, other people's kids, home furnishings. That's female only, female rube. 6. Food, where eaten, size of portions, and prices of. 7. Opinions, almost invariably don't like, about politics, celebs, and prices. That's basic rube conversation. How many times you heard a guy say, "Hey, Charlie, how are you?" And Charlie says, "How are you, Fred?" Good to see you, Charlie. Well, it's good to see you, Fred. Yeah. Well, what have you been doing, Charlie? Oh, yeah, the wife, I'll tell you what. Oh, yeah, listen, we had a great time. The wife and I went to see that musical with, what's her name, the movie star. She was with the Humphrey Bogart. It's really great. I like a musical, I don't know why these critics are always putting down musicals. I like them. I like to be able to come out of a show and hum a tune like, let's see, Like, what's this one I saw? Yeah, I was humming it for a week. They come out and I said, people, oh, like, now that's a musical, you know. I like that. What's her name? Barbara Streisand. They're very good. Oh, yeah, I like them too. Hey, you see, you ever watch Hee Haw? Yeah, oh, well, yeah, but you know, that dumb hillbilly stuff don't interest me. You know, that kind of stuff doesn't appeal to city guys like me, you know. I'll tell you what I like. I like Jackie Leonard. Now, Jackie Leonard's funny. You know, the other night he told a story about, he said to this guy in the audience, the guy got up and started heckling, you know, how to Johnny Carson, you know how to do it. God, he said, oh, it was a great put down. I'll tell you, I love him. Jackie Leonard, this guy gets up and starts to heckle him, and he hollers, hey, man, he says, what is that? Is that a banana you're eating, or is that your nose? Oh, the crowd it was just a fantastic bit. I'll tell you. Well, all right, this a typical conversation. Another one is, I don't know how you drink that rot gut. I'll tell you, I can't drink as much as I used to. Oh, yeah, but let me tell you, did I tie one on last Saturday night? You know, Mabel and I went down to the bowling alley. We met Frank at the bowling alley. You know Frank from down the shop? Well, we met Frank at the bowling alley, and Frank was having his anniversary. You know, he's been married to Arlene. Isn't that her name? Yeah, Arlene, the big, tall, skinny one. He's married to Arlene, see? Well, I'll tell you, we went to this place on Route 3. You know, I think it's called the Bluebird Tavern down Route 3 out there outside of Patterson. And did we tie one on? I want to tell you, I had a head for a week. This is a typical bragging about booze. Now, basic vocabulary. Basic humor. The basic is usually a good-natured person that has a sense of humor. Unfortunately, his lack of information or data about the non-rube aspects of the world drastically limits his ability to appreciate it. He automatically resents any jokes which he doesn't understand. However, he will laugh easily at those he does, including those which make fun of himself, but not of his culture. He enjoys repeating dirty stories when he can remember them. My favorite type of basic rube, if I may use Roger Price's lexicon. And in fact, this is the kind of rube that I don't know quite how. Hey, Nick, how are you at handling this kind of rube? We're talking about the rube revolution. You know, the basic rube. By the way, the basic medium of the rube is television. And the rube, if given his choice, would gladly elect Walter Cronkite president. And he would love to see Secretary of State, a deep thinker like Dick Cavett. That would make a great Secretary of State. See? that's basic rube ideology. And his politics generally are against. He's generally against most everything that's happening. And so any candidate that runs on an against platform is a sound candidate to a rube. Now, a typical example of rube humor is a guy, you come back by the water cooler, and you can always tell. He gets this lascivious look in his eyes. He says, hey, and you say, what, rube? And he says, hey, listen. He says, did you hear the one? And he looks around, see, skulkingly, to make sure that no chick from the steno pool is around. He says, hey, listen, did you hear the one about the bartender and the bowling dachshund and the three deep-frocked Franciscan monks on Third Avenue? Well, I wanted to... Of course, it doesn't do you any good to say, yeah, I have not only heard it, I have heard 5 million variations of the same rotten, stinking, crummy story. Stop it, will you? Now, the worst problem is how to assume a position with the face. What do you do with your face when a rube is telling you a boring, long, endless, totally pointless, dirty story? Now, what do you do? Well, generally what happens is the left side of my face starts to tingle. It starts to go to sleep. I find my face getting sort of hard around the edges, and I stand there, and it goes on and on. Now, salesmen are often given to this kind of thing. We have several, yes. And by the way, he considers himself a man of rapier-like wit. Speaking of rapier wit, this is WOR New York, your rapier wit station. And we certainly have it here. Do you want to hear some more... Listen, you want to hear what what Roger says? You want to hear what Roger says about information? This is basic facts of culture, rube culture. Now, here Here's the information that the Rube has at his disposal, basic information. In spite of the basics compulsion, he refers to them in his book as basics, the basic Rube. In spite of the basics compulsion to make instant and categoric judgments about everything, and by the way, this is the most consistent quality of the Rube. If you ask a Rube, say, what do you think is happening in the campuses? What do you think they ought to do about the campuses? Well, the Rube would say, ah, come on, are you kidding? And you'll say, no. Mr. Dilbach, would you please tell me what do you consider should be done about the campus situation today? Ah, come on, you're kidding, man. I mean, anybody knows that. You're putting me on? No, Mr. Dilbach, we'd like to ask your considered opinion. Ah, you know what they ought to do? I'll tell you, they ought to take them guys, you know them long-haired fagolas? You know what they ought to do? They ought to take them guys and give them a bat, see? After that, they give them a haircut, and I want to tell you, get them a job and draft them in the Army. That'll take care of the whole thing. Yeah. What are you, some kind of reporter or something? Say, no, Mr. Dilbach, I'm just a concerned citizen, and I'm interested in your considered opinion. Well, he looks at you in the rearview mirror, see, to make sure that you haven't got a tape recording him. And then the next thing he says, I'll tell you, there's a lot of things. And you know, it's all them guys. Lindsay, you take Lindsay. Oh, what an idiot that guy is. Lindsay, I want to tell you. I'll tell you, if Lindsay tried to run today, that guy couldn't get like the dog catcher in my own town out in Queens. That guy could not. What a dildock. I want to tell you, he's absolutely a dumb klutz. That's what he is. He don't know nothing. Well, that's interesting, Mr. Dilbach. How do you think he got elected? Are you kidding? Are you kidding how he got elected? What are you talking about? All them fagolas, they vote for him, the whole crowd. What are you talking about? All them professors, all them guys from TV? You're kidding? What was his name, Procchio Macchiacini, the guy to run against him? You don't think nobody listened to him? Procchio Macchiacini, nobody listened to him, and he had the right idea, I'll tell you. You know what he said? He said, you ought to go out there and get them guys a job. That's what they ought to do. And I want to pay this. You must be kidding. How did Lindsay get elected? Oh, wow. Well, thank you, Mr. Dilbach. This is my stop here. I'd like to say thank you for your... You ought to went over there. Yeah, thank you. I'd like to thank you for your cooperation. The next time I have a question that I'd like to ask about what's happening in the world, I'd be certainly delighted if I get the chance to ride in your cab and find out what you have to say about it.
Oh, that's all right, buddy. You know, I'll tell you, I like a good... I'll tell you, you're going to... My friends think I'm some kind of a long-haired intellectual or something, but I'll tell you this. You know what I like better than anything else? I like a good discussion of serious things. People don't talk about serious things, enough these days. You know that? That's what I said. The other day I was watching Merv Griffin, and I knew he's got a very deep show, and he says to Jar-Jar Gabor, and I...
So tonight we salute the Rube. R-R-O-O-B-B-B-B. Rube. Tonight we salute the Rube. Ba-ba-boo-ba-ba-da-da. Get more out of life. Go to a movie, Dad. Let's go to the bowling alley. Talk it up with Yogi. Hooray for Casey Stengel and the Mets. Yeah, yeah, M-E-T-S. Ho, 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 Eddie Crane. Pool. Da-da-do-do-do. Big old Ron Swoboda. Da-da-da-do-do-do. Hooray for Joe Namath and the whole crowd. Ba-ba-da-do-do-do-do.
Yeah, thank you. Very good. That was just beautiful. Elegant. Now, you want to hear about the basic information of the Rube that is at his fingertips, he says. In spite of the basics compulsion to make instant and categoric judgments about everything, he has very few points of reference upon which to base his opinions. Although the odds are 5-1 that he is a high school graduate, his lack of general information is blood-curdling. He recognizes a few names, but often has no specific idea of who they really are. He knows Hemingway was a writer, but does not know his first name or anything he ever wrote. Excluding a few selected handful of television and film personalities, no more than 4 presidents and or presidential aspirants, and a clutch of active sports figures, he knows with any degree of assurance only one. Here are the people he knows about. George Washington. Tarzan. Napoleon.
Snoopy, Picasso, Shakespeare, Hemingway, Julius Caesar, Abe Lincoln, Freud, the Jolly Green Giant, Rembrandt, Winston Churchill, David and Goliath, that's in parentheses, A. Hitler, Billy Graham, Mickey Mouse. He will recall having heard of, but be totally unable to identify. Now, come on, listen to this now. He will recall having heard of, but he will be totally unable to identify, one, Charlemagne, J. Paul Getty, Hannibal, Moby Dick, Macbeth, Robert McNamara, Benedict Arnold, Ralph Bunch. He will never have heard of Polonius, Henri Matisse, Norman Cousins, David Ben-Gurion, Norman Podaritz. Now, do you want to know some of the basic status symbols of rubes? Cameras. Rubes wear camera straps as if they were Legion of Honor ribbons. Formica. Combination stereo and color TV sets. Goldfish tanks with plastic plants and orange plastic castles. Cultured pearls, female. Salt and pepper shakers shaped like female breasts. Nutcrackers shaped like female thighs. Lawn flamingos, a real oil painting done by a female relative. Ashtrays from Hawaii, Mexico, or the Caribbean, or any nearest World's Fair. Now, do you want to hear what the basic drink of a rube is? Now, do you fit into any of these things? Basic drink. All cola drinks and coffee. Bottled or canned beer. 7 and 7 is considered a very sophisticated drink. That's Seagram's 7 Crown and 7 Up, which is an incredibly bad conversation. Rye and ginger. Vodka and orange juice. Basic cuisine. For any special occasion, steak, and only steak. Otherwise, French fried anything with ketchup. Barbecued anything, instant anything. Pizzas, spaghetti, and constantly at any place at any time, hamburgers. Basics and their families eat a lot of cold cereals with milk, but seldom drink milk or eat cheese, except on a burger, after they're 10 years old. Do you hear that? They seldom drink milk or eat cheese, except on a burger, after they're 10 years old. In Chinese restaurants, they always have egg rolls, chow mein, and chop suey. They never, ever order anything in a restaurant that they haven't had before. That is absolutely basic. How about basic hobbies of rubes? Do you like this one? Basic hobbies. In addition to talking and drinking, the basic rube is addicted to a number of other leisure time activities. One of the more specialized of these hobbies is A, gawking. Whenever there is a disaster, rubes rush from their homes into their cars, and within a matter of minutes, they have clogged the highways, making it difficult, if not impossible, for legitimate personnel, ambulances, and fire trucks to get there. That is a basic rube. Once on the scene, they line up by the thousands and stare for hours at the building where the old lady was decapitated, at the spot in the ocean where the airplane crashed and sank with 125 on board, or the 7-car auto wreck. They consider it a major triumph that they arrive in time to see actual bodies or blood. Strangely enough, many of them become queasy at the sight of blood, but this doesn't in the slightest deter them in their rush to view it. If not restrained by the police, they will grab buttons, fragments of the plane, even a victim's shoes as, quote, souvenirs. They snap each other's photos in front of the spot where the tragedy occurred. They buy hot dogs from the vendors who invariably show up, even at 3 a.m.,
They drink whiskey from half pint bottles. It's carnival time. B, this is the second Rube activity, bowling. Bowling is to Rubes what fox hunting was to the British aristocracy. It offers them a chance to drink and smoke while they exercise, and they can bring along their women. C, general. Older basics have an admirable tendency, inherited from their classic Rube parents, to build stuff. They have power tools. They build walls and patios in their backyards. They rewire their houses. They rebuild automobiles, sometimes spending fantastic effort on ingenious and incredibly powerful monstrosities for display at drag strips. They operate and will often build their own boats. Unfortunately, many of their children, now that's the older Rube, see, many of them, many of their children, those who have been born in the city, are losing their instinct to do it yourself. They may buy or rent boats and still have a strong interest in automobiles, but they seldom redesign them at any extent and generally buy them just to wreck them or trade them in. They show their interest mostly by watering them with a hose on Saturday afternoons. D, sports biz. That's one word. Sports biz is his third major leisure activity. Although mouse catching is no longer necessary for urban pussycat survival, kittens will stalk and pounce on bits of paper, and little boys will yell. Perhaps more relevantly, bang, you're dead. The young of all species attempt to learn in their play the skills they will need to survive as adults. Young men in ancient times would play at battle. This mock sport, mock battle, was called sport. Excluding rock throwing and wife kicking, the first sport was undoubtedly wrestling. In a few thousand years, other activities pertinent to the times were developed. Javelin throwing, competition for swords and staves, archery, running, various team games played with the ball, and jousting on horseback. In this way, men learned techniques, tested their courage, and strengthened their back muscles. It was all very practical. Today, however, instead of sports, we now have sports biz. Boy, if that isn't true. And, of course, it's... I'd like to throw in my little hooker here that in addition to sports biz, that you know, the competitors and so on, sports biz includes a whole host of, you might say, unified barnacles that attach themselves to sports biz. The commentator, the guy who interviews Joe Namath in the halftime, the innumerable guys named Jim who wear these CBS blazers, who show up in Garmisch-Partenkirchen with earphones on their heads. And there's every network in the world now has a man named Rune Arledge. I think there's a factory where you buy them, you know, and he's in charge of all sports biz. And that's a new thing. I don't think he's mentioned this because incidentally included in that is the new rash of vicarious outdoor shows. So guys who no longer, you know, it's a drag to drive all the way up to Maine to fish for a fish you're not going to catch. And it's dull, too. It rains, you know. So what you do is watch Rip Torn, a fish with Rock Hudson and, you know, and Joe Foss. And they never miss. They always catch him, you see. And so it's become, that is part of sports biz, and incidentally is part of the Rube world. He says, today we have sports biz, athletic competitions held as were the Roman spectacles, not for the benefit of the competitors, but for the spectators. The plebeians, using the classic Roman term. We are letting someone else do it for us. Our play, like almost everything else in our mass culture, is done by specialists who perform on the telly so that millions of weekend fans can sit at home in their T-shirts, holding millions of cans of beer, and be vicariously involved. Americans have long been accused of being spectators, but this type of activity is not even spectatorism. It is more accurately indirect spectatorism. Someone else, the box, is even doing our watching for us. An actual trip to a stadium or a ballpark is considered a big adventure. It's done maybe once or twice every couple of years. Comparable to, and often as exhausting as, something they never do is taking an overnight hike. And it's a big thing. Yeah, well, we went to the stadium one time. I'll never forget. We actually saw Phil Rizzuto. As a matter of fact, you know, I go out to Yankee Stadium quite a lot. You know that to give you an idea of how this has grown, that the guys who broadcast the games now, because they're really the heroes to the people who watch. because they're the intermediary. They're their stars. They're constant. And so the guys that have broadcast them have become bigger heroes than the broadcast than the stars. In other words, Roy White is not nearly as big a hero out at Yankee Stadium as Phil Rizzuto, who broadcast the games. And did you notice recently a major sports award was given to Kurt Gowdy for major contribution to sport? Now, I don't know what Kurt Gowdy plays. He's all. By the way, there must be a whole. I'm beginning to believe there's a whole stable of Kurt Gowdys. There can't be one. He's on at least seven different sports shows a week. You know, this is Kurt Gowdy's one. He's fishing for golden trout in Alaska, and then he's doing the Fig Newton Bowl. This thing played somewhere. Kurt Gowdy's always on hand, and so Kurt Gowdy is much more important to people today than the people that he reports on. But this is true. This is happening in many other areas. A lot of people believe that a folk singer, for example, is more important than the people she supposedly sings about, or he. And so you find a great host of intermediaries now are springing up. You'll find that in the, let's take politics, we'll take this case, that the commentator on the politics, the political scene, is often considered superior to the man he comments on. And certainly that's true in the Broadway theater. The rule believes in critics completely. And you'll find that today on the Broadway scene, of course it's been for a long time, but it's even more so now, that the word of the critic is far more important, and he's much more of a celebrity than the star of the show among the people. In fact, I'll never forget one night, I was in a Broadway show, and the night that Walter Kerr was in the audience was the biggest night. You know, everybody, the whole cast was flipping. It was fantastic. And they all, where's he sitting? Oh, no, I saw him, actually. You know, look at that. Gee, he's not as tall as I thought he was. And the night before, in the same theater, the people like Paul Newman had been there and Daryl Zanuck had been there. Nobody mentioned, you know, that was nothing. But the minute that Walter Kerr came, there was an electric thing went through the cast. And so even they're affected by it. In other words, on the other side of the footlight, that's also happened. This attitude of removal, he says, and that's a good point, indirect spectatorism, this attitude of removal is not confined to the sedentary middle age, but is totally accepted by the young. By the time they're 14, most kids today have lost their interest as participants in sports. They don't want to grow up to be baseball players, prize fighters, or football heroes. No contemporary Frank Merriwell goes to college today with the hope of, quote, making the team, unless he weighs over 240 pounds or is at least 6'8". The players who will be on the team are already scouted and evaluated by professionals when they were in junior high, and once on the team, they're rarely looked up to as heroes. They are, in fact, commonly referred to by the other students as jocks, beefs, and apes, and are regarded as creatures apart, professional entertainers, gladiators. Well, that in the world, of course, I say, and I'm going to throw in something here and add this to what Roger has to say about that. I think that this stems from a basic sense of inadequacy, which total spectatorism has bred on people. You find that people both love and hate their showbiz characters. Most people really seriously believe, well, no, what do you mean? I love Paul Newman. Oh, well, I beg to differ. I suspect that more people will devour a shred of reputed gossip about the person that they reputedly love than any other single character in the world. In other words, people love to see their heroes fall even more than they love to see them go up. And I predict that in another year, there's going to be guys after Joe Namath's scalp. They're going to be screaming bloody murder. Their faces are going to be red, and they're going to be out there throwing beer cans down at Shea Stadium. Because the fall of a hero is often much more exciting to the rube than the rise of the hero, because he is now assured that he is superior. He can throw a beer can down at Joe Namath, and Joe Namath can do nothing except limp off the field in defeat. The rube is never defeated because he never participates. And that's basic rubism right there. I mean, he's continually sitting on the sidelines writing a snide letter, which is not signed. This is basic Rube. And by the way, I would have to also add, there's other things that the Rube does. He believes in Dear Abby. He actually believes that the people who answer questions in newspapers are qualified to answer them. And he thinks of these as experts. He said, "Hey, did you see what Dear Abby said the other day? You know, she said that about that kid, you know, that kid at the school comes home with the long hair. She said, get him a haircut. You know, I've been saying it for years. And, you know, she really's got a head on her shoulders." But this is basic Rube attitudes. Now, another thing I'd like to point out, too, that Roger doesn't point out, that there are Rube sports that are more, that are, let's say, super Rube sports. For example, the roller derby. There's TV wrestling. These are sports where the super Rube really is at his best. And I would also like to say this, that the Rube secretly likes fixed games. He likes games that are fixed because he likes to feel that he's on the inside. He does. He also likes to, yes, have you noticed how sports guys will eat up the idea that maybe Denny McLain was involved with gambling? Oh, wow, that's the biggest story of the year. See? Not that Denny McLain won 31 games, but that he, you know, he might have made some bets on a football team. That this is exciting to a sports fan. And incidentally, it also makes him, again, feel superior. A sports fan, or a Rube, I shouldn't say sport fans, the Rube loves to feel superior. In his inferiority, as he wallows in his four mica apartment, you see, surrounded by his half-empty Ballantine beer cans and his flickering TV set, you know, and the marching squadrons of cockroaches that move across his J.C. Penney carpet that he bought. He loves to feel that he's on top of it. He's with it, you know. And another thing that the Rube loves is packaged vacations. He loves the two-week trip that includes everything, and at the bottom it says, including tips. He loves that. And this is, you know, it's a thing. And by the way, Roger also points out that one of the other extracurricular sports of the Rube is seduction. When a basic attempts to hustle a lady basic, he first tries to get her drunk. Yes, this is a Rube characteristic, very much so. Then he begins grabbing her and says, "Oh, come on, what's the matter with you?" He considers this a very persuasive question. He keeps wrestling and grabbing and repeating it until he either succeeds or is rebuffed. At which point he says, "I knew there was something wrong with you." And, the next day he's got all kinds of rumors about the girl. The vacation is also a big point of his life, and the weekend trip. The vacation is included under hobbies, but it is, for the basic Rube, much more. It is a ritual. It is the one time he is on his own, away from his job, away from the box, but never, of course, away from himself. Summer is the season for the great Rube move. That's one word, Rube move. When June comes busting out all over, you can spot cars full of them on every major artery, their faces set in a terrible look of purpose. Their purpose is, first, get there. Second, immediately then, measure the gas mileage it took for them to get there, and then talk about that for months. What? That's so true. What? Well, he says, trip time is a time for food. His meccas are any state with vacation land printed on its license plates. Also on the paper placemats in roadside restaurants, or any historical landmark, that's in caps, or any authentic reconstruction with attendants wearing period costumes, or any World's Fair, or any place he didn't see last year because he knows the fun people aren't there. Trip time is time for fun food. Anything that comes in a wrapper on a paper plate with a flag on it, or is over... or is over 8 inches high with a maraschino cherry on top. And, as always, hamburgers, cheeseburgers, and pizzas. A Rube child can smell a pizza at a distance of 1,500 yards with the wind against him. Rubes never eat the specialty of the region, ever, unless it's been breaded and deep fried so it tastes exactly like a French fry and comes with ketchup. Their vacation pastimes are, one, littering. 2, eating, sleeping or sitting in a Howard Johnson. 3, squeezing into the most crowded part of a beach and greasing one another. 4, walking slowly and suspiciously down the main street of a resort town and comparing the menu prices posted in different windows. 5, spotting license plates from back home and accosting the drivers. 6, sitting in their own cars overlooking any place called scenic and reading a newspaper as they do. 7, buying postcards. 8, buying fake Dresden figurines in a cut-rate Armenian store to remind them of the rugged coast of Maine. Have you ever been to Bar Harbor? There's 10 of those places. Vacationing rubes all look as if someone blew a bugle at 4 a.m. and they all got up and got dressed in the dark. The females no longer wear men's shirts, capri pants, and rollers in their hair, but are now seen in casual wear, recommended by Women's Day and the supermarket Vogue. They wear mini skirts, Bermudas, bell-bottom slack suits made from flamboyant prints, reminiscent of the rainforest, halters, large hats with Dacron ponytails attached, and stacked heel sandals. They like plastic articles in which forms of marine life can be embedded, or any straw article with shells on it, or fun jewelry shaped like flora or fauna. They carry satchel-y handbags decorated with 1, plastic flowers, 2, alligators, 3, carrots, and wear sunglasses encrusted with busted glass. 4, non-casual occasions, they have at least 1 pastel-colored outfit which is, quote, matched. Pink or powder blue sweater, skirt, stubby shoes, and a jacket with fur trim. The male, in addition to their cameras, wear those sports shirts in inexplicable colors, which even when new, look as if they've been washed 12 times, which cost $4.95. You know those curious plaids they always wear? The amount a basic pays for his shirts is in some way permanently impressed on his mind. He will spend $20 in a bar, buy a $3,800 car, a 600-color TV set, but will never, ever spend more than $6 on a shirt, unless he's on a golf or a bowling team, in which case he'll pay anything they ask. Oh, man, this is a very funny book. And, you know, maybe there is a slow leak in Iowa. I don't know. That's The Great Rube Revolution by Roger Price. Incidentally, I'd like to also add one more point here, that we in America have suddenly become aware of our peasantry. Every other country in the world knows all about its peasantry and has a word for it. For example, there is a word called, have you ever heard the word, the lumpenproletariat? Well, that's all that Roger's describing here. And we have a great body of hot dog eaters, ketchup sloppers, the ones who wear the harlequin white glasses with the blue busted glass all over them, the ladies with the blue hair sitting endlessly in Howard Johnson's. This is all part of the peasantry, the bourgeoisie. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's part of life. Now, the problem with the intellectual, and that possibly includes Roger, is that he considers those people the enemy. Well, are they? That's the question I'm asking. Are they? Or are they ultimately the ones who will fight the wars and, you know, build the bridges and do all the things that have to be done? They're the guys that drive the trucks that deliver the beer so that Roger can enjoy it at his party, you know? And ultimately, you know, we're all part of it together. Ah, the great lumpen proletariat. By the way, I could stand a cheeseburger and a good A&W root beer right now.